Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews as we enter 2022. My guest this week is Jennifer Uzzell. Now, Jennifer did a master's degree at Lampeter and was a full-time teacher in a secondary school. And death in the afterlife is a core theme that runs throughout Jennifer's research. Her original background is in theology and biblical studies. She did her first degree at Durham, and we learn about how her interest in Hinduism developed, and she is now a senior A-level examiner. Now, Jennifer's latest research, again at Durham, is on Druidry and Druids' attitudes towards death and dying. We talk about how on many levels she is squaring circles in her life. We learn about how she became involved in the funeral director business, which in some respects could be construed as a form of therapy. Now, Jennifer didn't see a dead body prior to working in a funeral home, and we find out how she does the job, how she has the right resources to do it, and how she has a vocational role, both to the bereaved and to the dead. We talk about how Jennifer's job impacts on her research and vice versa. And we talk about the different ways of conducting funerals that work for each family. In one case, it involved juggling and drinking whiskey. And she devoured Greek mythology as a child, and Jennifer talks about the paucity of work on non-Christian traditions when she was an undergraduate. She has always been interested in how words are used in translation, and she talks about why she considers herself an anthropologist of religion and being aware of watching herself watching. She talks about being an insider, both as a druid and as a funeral director. We talk about the important role of fiction in paganism. We talk about re-enchantment, the importance of myth and magic and folk horror. And towards the end of the interview, Jennifer talks about the way funerals can be a way for families to reconnect. And we discuss the role of connecting with an imagined past. And at the very end of the interview, Jennifer talks about her role in historical reenactment. It was an absolute privilege for the first nostalgia interview of 2022 to catch up with Jennifer Uzzell. My name is Chris DC. Well, it's an absolute pleasure this week to meet Jennifer Uzzell. And we were just saying, Jennifer, before we started recording, that we met at a conference in 2019 at Leeds Trinity. And you were telling me at the time all about the wonderful research you're doing, in which, am I right in thinking, there's a Lampeter dimension?
Well, there is, in that I did my master's degree at Lampeter. And when I was doing that, I was teaching full time. So I did it sort of part of the distance learning program. And I actually did the master's program in world religions. And at the end of it, when I went and looked back over all the modules and the dissertations, I realized that there was a theme of death and the afterlife running through it, which wasn't actually intentional at the time. I just realized that that's what I'd done. So that was clearly where my interest lied.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it, how sometimes you can be engaged in a project and you have your objectives, your reasons for doing them, and then you look back. And often, of course, it's very easy. I'm guilty of this. You start to see all these patterns and think, oh, but of course, based on where I am now, it's obvious that I would have come here. But maybe at the time you were doing it, if somebody had said to you, if your future self had said, this is where you're going to be, you probably would have run a mile.
I would have been absolutely horrified, actually, yes.
Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit about what actually you were researching at the time and what your present research is on?
Okay, so my original background, quite bizarrely, is in theology and biblical studies. So I did my undergraduate degree at Durham, and that was straightforward theology, specialising in biblical studies, which kind of gave me an interest in the ancient Near East and those sorts of religions, which I think I'd always had anyway. And then it was actually many, many years later, when I'd been teaching for quite a long time, that the opportunity to do the master's came up. And by that time, I had something of an interest in Hinduism, which started from reading a school textbook in a sort of quiet moment. And that developed into that developed quite radically, actually, because I'm now a senior examiner in Eastern religion, so I write A-levels, you know. So. And I was interested in all religion. I think I was born interested in all religion. And so, you know, the opportunity to do a master's was just really exciting. So I did that distance learning with Lampeter, which was, it took me 7 years, but it was just one of the most brilliant times of my life. You know, just going for the study weekends was just, and I met some amazing people who are still very good friends, including some of the tutors. And I wound up asking, as I say, I realized towards the end that there was this emphasis on death and dying all the way through. I did a long essay on near-death experience with Gregory Shushan. I actually cheated because I did, rather than do a 5,000-word essay, because I was really struggling for time because I was still teaching full-time at this point as well, I did an exam in Hebrew instead, which was one of the options because I'd already done Hebrew. So, you know, it may not sound like an easy option, but it actually kind of was. And I was supposed to do 5 essays and then a few other tasks and then a dissertation. And I actually asked if I could combine 2 essays. So I did 1 10,000-word essay instead of 2 5,000, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And my long essay was on, again, it was with Greg. And it was about the connection between mystery religions in the Hellenistic world and early Christian ritual, with a particular emphasis on baptism and Eucharist. And that was absolutely fascinating. And again, that doesn't sound like it has strong death connections, but it really does, because the whole theology around all of those things in both the mystery religions and in Christianity is about overcoming death. And then my dissertation was on the Vedas in Hinduism, and on the point at which the doctrine of reincarnation first enters Hindu thought, because it's not there in the Samhitas, which is the earliest layer of scripture. So again, there's the sort of death connection. And my current research, my PhD research, and this was fascinating because everything I had ever done before was to a greater or lesser extent textual criticism. And so I thought I would make things easy for myself and go straight into social science. And I'm currently studying modern Druids in Britain and their beliefs, rituals, attitudes around death, dying, funerals, the ritualization of death and all that sort of thing. So the methodology there is largely interview based. So that was a bit of a steep learning curve.
Yeah. No, that sounds like absolutely amazing, because it sounds as though along the way, you know, you really developed, it's almost as though there was this research program, this research project that you were destined to do. And then and it was only through doing it, or maybe doing something related to it, that it all sort of came together and you said, right, you sort of then honed in. Because when you were teaching, were you teaching religious studies at school?
Yes.
Yeah.
So in secondary school, yeah, and up to A level. Yeah.
So in that sense, there's something very holistic about what you've done.
Yeah, I've kind of got all the loose ends from everywhere in my life and sort of brought them together in the PhD, I suppose, which is quite good.
Yeah. And where are you doing the PhD?
I'm back at Durham.
Yeah.
So I'm back where I started.
Literally. So there's a theme going on here, Jennifer, of yeah, squaring circles.
Yeah. I'm back in the same department.
and I've been to the department. In fact, I interviewed some of the colleagues and PhD students there. But I was interested as well in exploring what you're doing now, because I think you hinted at it now, because you work in the area of funeral homes. In fact, that's what you do. So it sounds as though, I mean, you know, you do interviews for your research, but you actually work, you know, hands-on in an environment that must be, although in some ways I'm sure very rewarding, also must be really challenging and emotional to be dealing with, you know, the families of people who are obviously bereaved.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is what I said, if you'd asked me when I was doing my master's, I would have been absolutely horrified. Because a kind of recurrent theme through my life from being about 14 onwards has been this absolute terror of dying. You can kind of call it aversion therapy, I suppose, working in funerals. And when I was doing my master's, I had absolutely no idea that this was where I was going to wind up. I towards the end of the time when I was doing my master's, I got divorced. And I met someone new who is my current partner, who was a funeral director, much to the amusement of some of my friends at Lampeter, who had been saying, the narrative of your life is going in this direction. And I was going, no, it isn't. And then I can remember meeting a friend in Durham and saying, this is my partner, Keith. He's a funeral director. And she was like, pardon, Jenny? He's a what now? And again, you could write a book about the story of how it came about, but we ended up buying a funeral home. So it is actually ours. We run the business and we try to do it differently.
I was just thinking as well that because you're running a funeral home as well, what you were saying about aversion therapy is actually interesting, because I'm wondering if I had the same sort of experience, because there was this absolute dread, which might actually have come about largely because I had very few family members who actually died. But I was aware, and it may be like when you're at school and you find out that the father or the mother of somebody at school has passed away and they're very young, and you think, oh, what if that happened to me? How would I manage? And it's interesting that despite years of studying death and the afterlife and teaching it to students, it's not like then suddenly if somebody, and it does happen, and it must happen to you, people say, so what happens when you die? It's not like I then turn around and say, oh, I've been studying this for 30 years, I know the answers. It's quite the opposite. And I wonder if on some level, I'd never really thought about it before, but I wonder if it's a form of therapy. It's like, it's the big ultimate question. And the best way to deal with it, rather than avoid it, is actually to tackle it head on. And that actually becomes the palliative. That's actually a very good way of dealing with it. Doesn't mean you know all the answers, but actually, like with William James and the idea that it's about the fruits of what you do. It's not just whether religious experience is true. Well, of course it's true for the person who has it, because it changes their life. And I wonder if that's an element that maybe is coming through in your own rationale for doing this.
I think definitely. It's when we started, I didn't know if I was going to be able to do it or not. And I had just given up teaching. And I'd given up teaching because I was coming to have a very, very big role in examining. And my school was not being accommodating over that. And I sort of made the decision that, I was going to go with the examining, because I felt I could then have some sort of positive influence on the study of religion on a national scale. So to do my examining job, I basically needed a computer and a telephone. And when Keith was obviously the one who had the history of funeral directing, and when we had the opportunity to take over the funeral home, I said, well, I'll come in and I'll do my job with the computer and the telephone, but I'll be there so I can to some extent act as a receptionist, and then I'll see you occasionally, because funeral directing is the sort of thing that has unpredictable and long hours. So that's what we did. And it very slowly, I think, dawned on me that it was turning into something of a vocation. And I had actually, the strangest thing, I'd actually, like an awful lot of people in Britain, I think, I had never seen a dead body before at all. And I didn't until I'd been working in the funeral directors for nearly 8 weeks, which was the strangest thing. And Keith was wonderful. He was just sort of, it got to the point where he was leaving doors open and saying, for example, there's such and such in the mortuary, would you go and get it? There is somebody in there, you don't have to. And so it was very much me controlling my access and how comfortable I felt, and discovered that I actually had no issue with their bodies at all. And it sort of reached a point when we'd been doing the job, I think, maybe for about 10 months. And we were dealing with the mother of a lady who was my age, and her name was Jennifer. So we'd been sort of talking deeply. We'd been around the house to do the arrangements, and we sort of hit it off. And she'd asked us to put makeup onto her mum, and she'd given us her mum's makeup. And I said to Keith, I'm a woman. I've got probably more experience of makeup than you have. Can I do it? And, it was a hugely powerful experience to do that and realize that, you know, while a lot of people's initial reaction to somebody that's dead is revulsion or fear, my first reaction was, I think, compassion, but also sort of, it was almost a protective feeling. You know, this person is as vulnerable as it's possible to get. And it falls to me to make sure that when people come and see them, they look how they would have wanted to look, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And we've had some horrendous stories, as you can imagine. We've been going 10 years now. And I remember saying to Keith once, because I got very upset about one particular situation, and he said, well, are you sure you can do this? And I said, well, you know, as I see it, if I'm going home in tears every night, then obviously I can't do this job. That's no way to live. If I never go home in tears, I probably shouldn't be doing this job. And, you know, this, I mean, I know that some funeral directors, and I know there was actually somebody did their PhD on this back in the 90s. A lot of funeral directors deal with it by building walls and by objectifying the dead to the extent of, you know, we have to get this there by then. And to me, that seems entirely the wrong way of doing it. I don't see how that is actually helpful, because yes, it is a hugely emotionally challenging job, but it's also hugely beneficial to be able, I mean, you can't go into a situation and make it better. You can't. Well, you can. You can't go into a situation and fix it, but you can make it better. And that, to me, seems to be an incredibly useful thing to do. And yes, it does help. I mean, I still have issues. And I suppose the resources I have to be able to deal with those issues are academic study, which has always been my first recourse, and the actual experience of living and working with the bereaved and the dead. And I see my sort of vocational role as being to both, to the bereaved and to the dead. And the problem isn't fixed, but it's the best I can fix it, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does, because I'm just thinking as well that having interviewed Penny Sartori, who you may well know, who was working in not just a hospital, but in the ICU unit as a half a hospital, and dealing on a daily or regular basis with people who were dying. And then it's as though the academic study was her way of trying to understand and process something, which actually no doubt made her stronger in her job, because obviously this was something that really affected her. And I'm just thinking of what you're saying. It's actually important, I think, for the people for the families who come to you. Obviously, they're very upset, they're very broken and very vulnerable. And if the person in the funeral home is building these walls, it might come across that there's a lack of passion, lack of compassion. Yeah. And I'm just thinking that somebody said to me some years ago, because I used to be the senior tutor at the place where I work, and I was dealing with students daily, and someone said, you know, every now and again, you probably need to go and see a therapist or counsellor yourself, because you need to offload. But what I found is interesting is that I did not, for that reason anyway, because in talking to the students, what I, and this is a paradox, and it on paper, you'd never think that they could work this way around. There is something quite therapeutic on the part of the person who is being offloaded to. And I'm guessing that it must be very similar in your case, that I don't know if you mentioned, for example, to any of the families who come to you because a family member has died, that you research in this area. I don't know if I'm guessing in some cases it might be appropriate to mention it. In many cases, it probably absolutely isn't, but it must give you a personal angle that at least shows that there's a level of care in this. Yeah. It's not just that you're sort of an unfeeling bureaucrat.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. There are some families where it would be of no interest to them whatsoever. And there are other families that are very interested in it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's very much the case. And also, we are part of a movement, and a colleague of mine coined the term progressive funeral directors a while ago, which was brilliant, because up until then we were using sort of alternative, and that I really didn't like alternative funerals, because we're not doing anything that ought to be alternative. It's not like every funeral that we do is really unusual or not traditional. Some are. But this sort of progressive, and we're affiliated with the Good Funeral Guide. And actually, you know, what you were saying about support and therapy, that's where it comes from us, because there's a group of funeral directors that are very much coming from the same place, sort of ethically and emotionally. And we talk to each other, which is really useful in terms of reminding yourself that it's not necessarily us that are crazy. So, yeah.
And I'm guessing that, yeah, because I'm guessing that you get lots of recommendations or people, you know, for whom that you're offering a service that, because obviously it's not the sort of thing that you normally think about until until you have to think about it. And I can easily imagine that you are offering something that is, you know, if more people knew about it, then that would be so helpful for people. Yeah. Where are you based, actually, Jennifer? So are you actually in Durham?
No, we're in Darlington, which is about 16 miles south of Durham.
Oh, yeah, not too far. Yeah, so in that sense, it sounds as though you're doing a phenomenal job and 10 years as well. But I suppose the inevitable question is, to what extent is your job, whether you're conscious of it or not, impacting on your research and vice versa?
Well, it has to an extent. My research is quite specific in terms of researching a particular religious community. I'm going to use the word religious there, although it's, as you know, problematic almost always. And that's not a community that I deal with professionally, by and large. But a lot of the principles and a lot of the ideas, we work quite closely with a natural burial ground, for example, that's quite close to us, and they are absolutely brilliant. So a lot of the same ethical principles that I come across in my research feed into families that want to do that. And also a degree of, I'm going to say, ritual literacy. This sort of gut feeling about doing particular things. And in terms of, I suppose, impact, my feeling is that Druids and pagans in general, actually, are very, very good at ritualizing. Whereas the wider world, unless in a particular religious context, isn't. So there are fantastic, for example, civil celebrants that will do non-religious ceremonies, and the liturgy, so the words that they use can be fantastic, but what is missing, to my way of thinking, is ritual. And one of the impacts that my research is sort of having is ways of taking ritualizing what is an incredibly significant event in a way that is not necessarily specifically religious. And it can be tiny little things, but it's thinking in that way. And that is definitely influenced by my research. So, you know, just for by way of an example, we did a funeral for a lady who had been a fairly well-known singer in her youth. And at the committal, when the curtains closed around the coffin, we had everybody stand up and clap. And it's a little thing, but, you know, this is kind of what I mean by ritualizing, that it doesn't have to be religious, but just thinking in terms of things that you can do and ways that you can involve the people, rather than, so that the funeral is something that they are involved in rather than something that happens to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, so in that way, there is definitely a conversation that goes between my professional practice and my research.
Yeah, funerals are, I was talking to a former PhD student of mine whose father is a vicar, and she was saying that her father always preferred to officiate at funerals rather than at weddings. And there's the irony, and it happened in my case at my grandfather's funeral. So he was 95. And of course, one thing you don't take photographs at a funeral, or maybe you do. I mean, part of me, there was almost a part of me, because I saw family members there that maybe I'd either never seen but heard of, but maybe, you know, hadn't seen for decades, if I'd seen them at all. And it was such a wonderful opportunity to catch up, that the funeral was a very sad occasion, but I felt strangely uplifted. But at the same time, under normal circumstances, of course, you'd be taking selfies or photographs and you'd be filming the event and you'd be celebrating, but you don't do that. So I suppose because I keep a diary, that was my way of recording what had happened. But in terms of what's taboo, what's allowed, what you just said is really interesting, because that obviously worked in the context of everyone clapping in relation to that singer. But on paper, you know, you might think that that would be a very strange thing to do, but it sounds actually really perfect and it seemed the absolutely right thing to do. So I guess to an extent, what you're doing is having to think and work with the family in terms of what actually is the right thing for them, what's bespoke. Otherwise, they're going to look back and think, you know, the funeral didn't really fit, or the person officiating didn't really understand what my father or mother or spouse or whatever was like.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, you know, every family is different. Every funeral is different. But making it different doesn't always have to be about really big things. Sometimes it is, you know, just the little things. You know, we had a family that, and in fact, actually, some of the most powerful funerals that I've been to have been where the family have conducted themselves. So they have done everything and we've been there really to make sure that the logistics work. And they've done everything else. You know, we've had a family that decorated the crematorium with branches of rosemary. And it was the person that had died was very active in local amateur dramatics. So, you know, there were people used, you know, again, I think very powerful. It didn't all happen at the front. They were using the aisle of the crematorium. There were people walking up and down and sort of using the whole space. We did another funeral for a guy who had been a traveling entertainer in the old tradition of that. His father had been very well known for this, and the funeral I think was one of the smallest we've ever had. There were three people there, but we had a sari over the coffin that made it almost into an altar. We had a bottle of whiskey and glasses on the coffin. We had candles burning. We had his juggling balls, because he'd been, you know, juggling was one of his things. And my partner, as it happens, can juggle. So he was, you know, the wife of the guy had asked him to juggle. So the basically the crematorium attendant put his head through the curtains and Keith was juggling. Everybody had a shot of whiskey. People were dancing in the aisles to the music. You know, it absolutely was not what you would imagine a funeral would be like. But for that person, it was absolutely perfect. And that is the memory that they will have. And this is the thing about, you know, the memory that you have of a funeral can be hugely detrimental. You know, you can remember, particularly, you know, if there's family conflict, or, you know, for all sorts of reasons, it can be a harmful memory, or it can be a memory that contributes to healing. And, you know, you look back on it and the feelings that you get from it are positive ones. And that's kind of what we try to do, I suppose, is to make sure, not that the funeral is all, you know, fun and laughter. And there's a lot at the moment about putting the fun back into funerals and it being a celebration of life. And I've got no problem with that. The problem is that my understanding of what the word celebrate means as an academic, I suppose, is different to the popular understanding of celebrate. And it leads people thinking, well, it's got to be a laugh from beginning to end. Well, of course it doesn't, because somebody's died. But that balance of emotion, I think, is really important to try and bring out.
And it works in lots of contexts, including in teaching, for example, where I always say to my students, well, I hope you enjoyed the lecture. And of course, and then I sometimes qualify that by just saying what I mean by that is, you know, obviously, I don't want you to hear to think, oh, God, we got, you know, if you feel it's a chore, if it's 2 hours of your life that you really don't want to be doing, then why are you here? But if you come away and by fun and excited, I often mean challenged, you're thinking maybe about something that you hadn't thought about before. It's a new lens for looking at something and you feel really engaged with something. I mean, I go to the cinema a lot. But, you know, the idea that it's just all I ever do is escapism, I think, well, yeah. Really? I mean, that doesn't, you know, that's an interesting angle about, you know, on the BBC News website sometimes where you've got anything to do with film or radio, it comes under the bracket, the subheading of entertainment. And, yeah. And I'm not sure I feel comfortable with that because yeah. For me, I don't know where the line between education and entertainment appears. If I'm writing a film review, you know, am I involved in something that's entertainment based or education based? And you're often dealing with people's perceptions around that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm interested, really interested as well, in the transition from working in theology and biblical studies, so being a textual scholar, because obviously that was your first degree, but how, and you're not the only one who's made that sort of journey. I know plenty of people who started out as, and some of, you know, very well, you know, very, very well-known people in our field who, yeah. who started off as biblical scholars and then, you know, maybe are now sociologists, et cetera. But in your case, how did you make that transition from being a more, shall we say, traditional scholar to somebody who embraced a far more eclectic range of traditions and perspectives?
Well, different traditions wasn't an issue because, as I say, I think I was born interested in everything to do with religion. Raises all sorts of interesting questions, really, as to why, because my parents weren't particularly. But I can, you know, I can remember I was sort of devouring Greek mythology when I was about 8 or 9. And, you know, so that in itself wasn't an issue. When I was, and this is, you know, in terms of coming full circle, this is an interesting one. When I was doing my degree, there was nothing on offer at Durham on other religions. There was one course, which I think was called Christian Perspectives on Other Religions. And even in my youth, when I was trying very hard to be a Christian and not really succeeding very well, I knew that was probably a very bad idea. So I didn't do that. And that my first real experience of anything outside Christianity was joining the Interfaith Society at university, and they went on trips to Mandir's and that sort of thing. It was like, oh, this is fascinating. So I've never really passed up an opportunity to learn about anything to do with religion. So that wasn't an issue. And I've always been interested in how words are used and how words are used to, and this, of course, is a textual thing. So there is, you know, you'll know this, there is a very big difference in terms of the meanings that you get from reading the Bible in English and reading it in Hebrew and being able to say, actually, they don't say the same thing. And so when I was doing my master's at Lampeter, I took the opportunity to do tiny, tiny little bit of Sanskrit. And again, to sort of, as the language as a way into the theology, which is absolutely fascinating. In terms of methodology, that was a lot more difficult. And it was because I was sort of going into a PhD without knowing the basics about the discipline I was coming into, which I see, I mean, a lot of people would say it was sociology, but I see what I do more as anthropology, even though I'm doing it in a modern Western context. I kind of think of myself as anthropology of religion and about the history of the anthropology of religion and the body of literature, I knew absolutely nothing. So I spent a lot of time reading stuff that, you know, most people coming in to do a PhD would have been doing certainly since undergraduate, and it would all be very familiar stuff. And I had to sort of start at ground level. That was quite tricky. What helped, I think, was that I have always had this, Terry Pratchett calls it third sight. It's watching yourself watching. And I've always been sort of very aware of that. So I watch people, and I think I've always watched people. And I've always been sort of connected with, well, that's what they say, that's what they do. What does that mean? What's the context of that? What are they actually telling me? And that's not the same. And, you know, obviously, researching Druidry, it's not a magical tradition in the way that, for example, Wicca would be, but there is a magical element. There is, oh, hate this word, but shorthand, a supernatural element. And dealing with the experiential side, I think it's really important not to be dismissive. So, you know, to say to people, yeah, you think that's what you experienced, but actually it isn't what you experienced. What you really experienced was this. Well, that's not good academia, apart from anything else. But at the same time, those things, as you say, you know, whether they're veridical or not, are real to the person, but they still happen within a context. And it's finding that context. And I find actually Jack Hunter's work on this really interesting, his work on ontological flooding, that a number of explanations for something can all be true at the same time, and you don't have to pick one. And, you know, when, you know, in my case in particular, when a druid tells me that they've had an experience with an ancestor or some sort of encounter with a non-physical being, they may be absolutely right that that's what happened, and there could be another context, and, you know, and maybe they're on a particular medication. Maybe that medication enables them to see something that is really there that most of us filter out most of the time. So both of those things can simultaneously be true. And, you know, it's coming into this sort of methodology of thinking that kind of took a while, but that I think has been incredibly useful. And also I've got the additional issue that I'm an insider researcher on two fronts. So I am a druid. That is sort of the banner that I would nail my flag to. Now, that is great in terms of access, but in terms of being taken seriously in academia, I'm also an insider because I'm a funeral director. So I take my own perspective and my own set of biases into that. And when I encounter quite a lot of druids are quite antithetical towards the funeral profession as they understand it to be. And of course, that's a bias that I largely share. So I've got to be quite careful about how I negotiate that route in terms of the voice of the researcher. And that's something actually that I've written quite extensively about in my methodology. Usefully, I think I'm not a pioneer here. There have been other insider researchers who have written about how they negotiate this boundary. I think it's Robert Wallace that talks about walking between worlds, and Susan Greenwood talks about being bilingual in terms of being able to communicate authentically and genuinely with both traditions, with the academic and with the pagan, in her case witchcraft, and be able to explain those two things to each other. So, you know, the task of being in that actually very privileged position is to be able to translate those two communities to each other in a way that is beneficial and helpful to both of them. How well all of this works, though, remains to be seen, because, you know, I haven't got the PhD yet, so it might not work at all.
But it's interesting because what you're doing, and I think this is what any PhD, and indeed actually also perhaps it's a metaphor for life as well, it's about unpacking paradoxes, that yes, something doesn't make sense, so you try to work it out. I mean, it's funny what you said about the supernatural, because I do work on Christmas, and of course, yeah, it's almost as though people say, I don't believe in the supernatural, it's mumbo jumbo, and yet they'll go and see Christmas films, which are all about, yeah, Santa and his elves. So we need it, and it may be only before, maybe it's a liminal thing, or maybe it's a calendrical thing, and we do it for a limited period, and then we go back to the every day. But without the magic, without the myth, without the Harry Potters and the Lord of the Rings and the Dunes and all the rest of it of this world, then there would be something quite impoverished. But that doesn't mean to say that you necessarily live by a certain set of rules that the film or the mythology dictates. But you need it to draw on, to draw off.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I think paganism, widely more than any other tradition, is self-consciously informed by fiction. Yeah. You know, there are so many pagans that I'm aware of that say they first came into paganism, and it depends how old they are, which it is, you know, whether it's Robin of Sherwood or whether it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer or whether it's The Craft. Yeah. And I think Carol Cusack writes quite a bit about this, that actually that's fine. That is legitimate. You know, that doesn't make it a made up religion, and any more than any other religion. And yeah, I think that's really interesting because paganism has that basis. I mean, you know, really from the 1900s onwards, I mean, the wind in the willows and, you know, these sorts of things of the generation before that. Yeah, that is entirely legitimate. You know, it's drawing on. It's not saying I believe that this is literally true and I'm going down to the woods to talk to Moli. I think of it as a way of looking at the world that is at least partially informed by fiction and popular culture.
Yeah, and it's funny with my students as well, because we do a module on modern Christian theology where we look at demythologization and we look at the way that in the middle of the 20th century it was, oh no, you can't possibly be, you know, engaging in something that is so pre-scientific. You know, we need to get rid of, you know, myth is the problem, let's strip it away. So you have demythologization in Bultmann's program. And it's wonderful and I love every bit of it. But of course the reason I love every bit of it is because there's a problem, and it was only really crystallized when my own students one year in particular were just looking at me like, why are we talking about this? What's the problem with myth? Yeah. And I think what I realized is that I was presenting Bultmann's program, but they were like, that might have been true 70 years ago, but we live in a world where we need myth and magic. And if you try and strip that away, you're left with just an empty shell. And I thought that was the key thing, that somebody goes to town on this. My undergraduate dissertation was on Bultmann. And yet it was only when I realized that in imparting this to my own students all those years or decades later, that I realized their answer was, but hang on, what is the problem he's trying to wrestle with? If we don't see the problem, then we don't recognize the solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a word that you encounter time and time and time again with Druids and with pagans more widely is the word re-enchantment. And it's this program of bringing the magic with a small m and no k, bringing the magic back into the world and making it a place that is imbued with meaning in a way that, you know, stripping that enchantment away takes away.
Yeah, and you're right, because it happens in everyday discourse as well, when sometimes, you mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I was at a conference some years ago with someone in, I think, Norway, no, I think it was Finland, and she was saying that when she was younger, she grew up with Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and she felt a bit marginalised. There were various reasons why she perhaps didn't sort of fit in. There was a sense of marginalisation, alienation. It completely resonated with her. And now all those decades later, she has a family, she has a job. But the thing that defines her is the fact that all those people who were now like her teenagers when they used to watch Buffy, they're now in their 30s, they have families of their own, they're all around the world. And yet they hook up through online sites where they're, you know, that's the thing that brings them together. That's what that's who they are. Yeah. And all those years later, it's the thing from childhood that they've never lost hold of, because that was the reason that allowed them to connect with the world. And now, even if their geographical, the people who are living around them don't share that, there is a go-to place. And I had it with radio, I still have it with radio. And it's funny that sometimes, you know, you can be walking down the street, you can be teaching your students, but there's something going on in your head which you're not sharing with anybody, but it's because of that you're able to speak in a certain way. You know, that's where your energy comes from. And a lot of that is private, a lot of that is untapped from the point of view of others. But if you took that away, it'd be like saying to somebody, well, you have an exam coming up, so you need to revise solidly for the next 2 months and do nothing else. And you think, well, there would be a paucity of experience if you did that. But it's almost the assumption that you can't do two things simultaneously.
Yeah. In actual fact, most of us do two or three things simultaneously all the time. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And your classic, you know, cognitive dissonance, I think that is something that pretty much everybody believes all of the time. I know that there's a book that... You see, this is another thing methodologically that's quite interesting, is that I'm drawing on so many different disciplines to do this. So ritual studies, pagan studies, death studies, bereavement studies, and I've got the literature from all of these, and actually archaeology as well, because I'm looking at these new barrows that are being built to take cremated remains and to explain, and in terms of your interest in nostalgia, oh my goodness, but to explain why they are powerful now, you have to know a bit about what they were then. So I've read quite a bit of archaeology as well. But The Continuing Bonds in Bereavement, which was a book where the researcher was looking at basically interviewing people over their experience of bereavement and the experience of the funeral. And one of the conclusions she came to that I thought was really interesting was that if you asked most of these people if they believed in life after death, if they believed in ghosts, the majority of them would say no. And yet they quite calmly, and as if it was the most normal thing in the world, reported having conversations with the person that had died. And they didn't experience these as just purely imagination. They experienced the real presence of this person. And this sort of dissonance where, you know, you sort of officially believe one thing, but you act as if you believe something else, I think is something that we all live with. And I remember Graham Harvey in, and I can't remember which book it was, I think it may have been Food, Sex and Strangers, but he said, you know, you ask most people living in the Western world, do you believe in magic? And they will say, no, absolutely not. And then you will give them a photograph of somebody that they love and you will ask them to set fire to it. And almost nobody will. And, you know, I think this actually reflects the state that we, all of us, live in pretty much all of the time.
And actually, just drawing on something you were saying earlier as well about the empirical, which is a new angle through which you're working. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because certainly my background was one of engaging with the theories and the concepts. And it's almost as though if you know all the key scholars and their arguments, you put them forward, then you're a very learned scholar and a great teacher. And then what am I doing now? I'm spending my time interviewing real people. In some cases, they're the people who've written some of these books. But the interesting angle is, where are you coming from? What's your angle? What's the purpose for doing this? What is it that keeps you motivated? And I think those are the sort of questions which maybe you don't think of, or you take for granted, or you just assume maybe at a younger age that there's almost this sort of objective presence, that this sort of objective research. But then you, in the real world, as you say, you can know all the great wonderful things about the theories of death and dying, but then that doesn't help you when somebody says, so in a practical scenario, what do we do? And you realize that you're all at sea. And I think that it's that navigation of the practical and the theoretical that actually is, in your case, by the sound of it, making for a really enriching PhD.
Well, I hope so.
I'm also, just as we start to be, well, we'll be starting to wrap up with a few more philosophically based questions, but I was just thinking as well in terms of other influences, whether through culture, through music, through film, that maybe along the way have helped guide you. Because I had this utter obsession when I was younger, which has never gone away, with the music charts, and that sort of is also my steer, my way of going through life, of, you know, through radio particularly. It was all channeled through radio. But is there anything like that as well in your case, whether particular musical musicians or filmmakers that have been particularly influential in the course of your life?
I can't think that there was much way back. I'm trying to think when I sort of started this term. I can remember being, I suppose it was quite a way back. You know, I was saying lots of people came into paganism through, you know, such and such. In my case, I read The Mists of Avalon when I was quite young, and I know I'm not alone in that. I also know it's problematic, but the book itself, I think what stuck in my mind, because I've always been very interested in textiles. I do quite a lot of textile crafts. I've done historical reenactment, which also, of course, feeds into this whole Druid thing. And a lot of what I did there was textile related, had to do with dyeing and weaving. And the idea that came up in the book that stuck in my mind more than anything else from it was the idea of weaving magic. So as you are actually physically weaving, you weave magic into it. And that's an idea that always stayed with me in one way or another. More recently, I think it's things that give you a particular way of looking at the world. And I think folk culture, I suppose, folk horror. I have to say I'm a great fan of The Wicker Man. It's not a great PR job for paganism, I have to say, but it's a wonderful film. And a particular, I suppose, way of, I mean, I love, I don't know if you've come across the band Telling the Bees, which is, it's a guy called Andy Letcher, was the front man and one of the very few other people I know who's done a PhD on Druidry specifically. It's not common. and has actually been personally very helpful to me. He sent me his PhD and, you know, all sorts of things. But he was the front of a band called Telling the Bees, and a lot of their music and the way it looks at the world. And they've got a song called The Puppeteer, which is about the importance of stories and how the world falls apart if you don't have stories. And he did another song, which I've actually quoted quite extensively in my thesis, with his permission, I hasten to add, that was called Raise Me Up a Golden Barrow. And it's about, I suppose, nostalgia and death. It's about looking back at an idealized death way in the past that is based in community and based in memory and based in song. And that has been very influential on me more recently. And he actually wrote a paper that I've just been finished reading that is talking about, I mean, he's primarily a musician. He writes about music and religion. And he had written a paper about sort of British folk culture and things like the Wicker Man and Morris dancing and the Obios, which are generally perceived within paganism to have pre-Christian origins, and which for the most part absolutely don't. But he say, actually, that doesn't matter. They weren't pagan, but they are now. They've become pagan. And yeah, that way of looking at the world through that sort of folk culture, I suppose, has been very influential for me.
And that's a perfect bridge, actually, Jennifer, to a few questions I want to present as we start to wrap up, which are very nostalgia related in terms of whether your memories are predominantly positive ones. And I suppose twinned with that, the question as to whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences.
Okay. Yes, I would say my memories are predominantly positive. I'm not one of these people that is naturally upbeat and happy all the time, I have to say. Slight melancholic disposition. But my family was very close and is very close and very loving. And my memories of growing up are by and large happy ones. And also, actually, going back to your previous questions, probably hugely influential, because I say my parents were not religious, and they're not. But my mum was very into maintaining traditions. So, for example, she would have us out at New Year wassailing my aunt's cherry tree, which led to all sorts of exciting things, like my aunt accidentally setting fire to her Wellington boots and running around and running into the tree, and burning a straw goat at Christmas as a sort of a scapegoat, because she'd read about that somewhere, and my other aunt starting a Save the Goat campaign. You know, these sorts of things. So this sort of immersion in sort of folk culture came right from my mum, and the sort of practical side, because we used to get bits of sheep's wool out of the fences and dye them with things, see what colours went. Is it possible to be nostalgic about a negative event? I'm not sure. I think from my professional background, a funeral is almost by definition a negative event. Usually, I say usually, not always, because it's very easy to class all funerals emotionally into one category. And my supervisor, Douglas Davis, has written extensively about this concept of offending death, deaths that seem to be particularly tragic or particularly wrong. But there is a corollary to that, that some deaths are, given that death is something that can't be avoided, it's part of the situation, some deaths, somebody that has had dementia for a number of years, where the death can almost be a relief to the family because they actually lost and mourned that person a long time ago. And the sort of funeral that you would need in that circumstance would be very different. And I would see, you know, for that sort of funeral, for example, I'd see one of the jobs of the funeral as being to put that person back together as they were before the dementia, which allows people to encounter that person and, I suppose, say goodbye to them. But funerals by and large are not positive, you know, they're not good experiences. There is always some sort of grief element, almost always some sort of grief element there. Yeah. But they can be things that you look back on with nostalgia because, you know, that was a good thing. That was, you know, that was a time when, as you were saying earlier, that was a time when the family reconnected. That was a time when We had a really good laugh about the thing that that person did. So yes, I would say it's possible, but I'd say it's probably not common.
Yeah, because I think sometimes at funerals you see a side to the person in the eulogy that may not coincide with what you knew of them. If, for example, they were a work colleague, and I had one colleague who passed away a few years after retirement, and he always seemed, he wasn't very happy. It was very clear that he wasn't very happy. He'd been around in the job a long time. I think he was very disillusioned. And he had a reputation, actually, in that sense, for being a bit jaded. And then at his funeral, you saw the things that really motivated him. And we never had those conversations. Yeah. I think on some level, that may have been an impetus to doing this podcast as well. Because I thought, well, what a pity that all those years, we always had those somber conversations about all the things he didn't want to be doing. And yet there was obviously things that really did infuse him, but they belonged in a different realm. And yet suddenly after he died, I got to learn about them. And it was that sense of almost like missing out on some wonderful experiences. So in a way, it's through a very horrible thing like somebody's death that you do at least get to maybe see a different side to them, which is a better memory to have, or a way that perhaps corrects or contextualizes the memory you had, than the one whereby you just sort of see them through a very perhaps narrow framework.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have to slip in something about the Barrows here, if you're talking about nostalgia. The funerals, I mean, these are Neolithic and Bronze Age style Barrows. I think there's five of them now that have been built in order to take human cremated remains. And they are proving incredibly popular. And one of my research fascinations is, why are they so popular? And this idea of nostalgia, this idea of connection to some sort of an imagined past, is one of those things that is incredibly important in that process. And for people that have done funerals or interments at these sites, the nostalgia of the funeral itself sort of mingles with the nostalgia that's built into the place, of this connection with what they see as being a better time. So you've almost got two sorts of nostalgia that are weaving into each other in that context, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because nostalgia is all about that sort of, you know, it's negative and positive in the sense that it's the bittersweetness, that there's something that you're missing, and actually a funeral context is a perfect example of that. There's the loss. But also the sense that the reason that you're here at all is because of the, in some cases, literally, obviously, if they're a biological relative, but you wouldn't be where you are today if it wasn't for them. And so there is reason to celebrate, but obviously there's the time and the place for it. And also, you know, sometimes it can raise eyebrows if then you have the wake afterwards. And of course, people are having lots to drink and you think, oh, you know, hang on a moment, you know, this is a very somber occasion. But there is no, and you've just demonstrated that, I think, really sensitively, the fact that there is no sort of single template that works for everyone. And actually, in the context in which you referred to it earlier, juggling balls, actually for that person sounded like the most fitting send off.
and I can see there being nostalgia for that funeral within the family, even though, and it was a particularly tragic death, it was an accidental death, so it wasn't expected. Right. But to take that and to make it into a memory that is at least partially positive is
absolutely. And I've got one more question for you, Jennifer. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, that's interesting. Both, I think. I would say probably the balance is on looking back. I do feel very strong nostalgia for certain periods of my life that were very positive. University the first time round, Lampeter is another very strong one. And of course, going back to Durham, and you can't go back because the place, you know, as Herodotus pointed out, the place you go back to is not the place that you were in. Yeah. The building might be the same, but, you know, and obviously I have an interest in the past, way beyond my own past. So, you know, this interest in ancient religion, the religious tradition that I study, I'm going to be extremely careful how I put this, at the very least takes its inspiration from the ancient past. And, you know, the connection to ancient Druids is not irrelevant. I have a a very strong background in historical reenactment. I was very deeply involved for a lot of my life in Saxon and Viking reenactment. And there's obviously there's a you know, must have been just like this element to that. And I suppose two aspects of nostalgia there, because there's a nostalgia, such as it is, connected with, is this, you know, what was it like? And learning the crafts that your ancestors would have known, and actually physically learning those crafts is a hugely meaningful act in itself, and it's a way of connecting. But also now, because I'm still a member of the society, but for various reasons, I pretty much never do anything with them. So I have a nostalgia for the time of my life when I was deeply involved in the reenactment and the people that I knew and the things that I was doing. So, yeah, both. I mean, I do look forward because my life seems to change radically from time to time. So it's always interesting to know where it's going. But I would think on balance, I look back.
Well, that's what a lovely considered answer, because what I really took from there, the multiple levels at which you're engaging with not just your own past, but also the historical past that precedes you, going back to Saxon times, for example, but also the fact that that is your past, because they're things that you don't perhaps do now, but you were doing years past. Yeah. And so you were imbibing the culture from a different age in your own different age. And yes. I think the way that that all comes together sounds as though, well, it, you know, as with so many people, you know, never a dull moment. But
nothing is ever simple. Yeah. You think it's Jennifer, simple, you've misunderstood it.
Jennifer, it's been wonderful to catch up with you. Thank you so much for being my guest.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's been lovely.